Several Issues Etc. regular guests are candidates for leadership positions in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Every LCMS congregation has received nomination forms for the president and vice presidents of the synod. Please encourage your pastor and congregational leaders to fill out and return these nomination forms before February 20th of 2019. Learn more at issuesetc.org/nominations. issuesetc.org/nominations.
There could be no greater contrast to the beautiful image of a mother holding her infant child than the chilling displays our nation saw in recent days. Lawmakers in New York cheered with delight upon the passage of legislation that would allow a baby to be ripped from the mother's womb moments from birth. These are living, feeling, beautiful babies who will never get the chance to share their love and their dreams with the world. And then we had the case of the governor of Virginia, where he stated he would execute a baby after birth. To defend the dignity of every person, I am asking Congress to pass legislation to prohibit the late-term abortion of children who can feel pain in the mother's womb. Let us work together to build a culture that cherishes innocent life. And let us reaffirm a fundamental truth. All children, born and unborn, are made in the holy image of God.
That's an excerpt from President Donald Trump's State of the Union address Tuesday night. It was the third longest in modern history. Some people were calling it a political pivot. Others were calling it the most pro-life State of the Union address that they have ever heard. And what were those white-clad women sitting in the gallery? What message were they attempting to send the nation as its eyes turned toward the president and his State of the Union address? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 6th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be discussing President Trump's State of the Union address. Mark Hemingway, a Washington, D.C. journalist for 20 years, will be our guest for the first half hour or so. Pastor Will Wheaton joins us after that. We will be studying the Epiphany hymn, I Want to Walk as a Child of the Light. He says it is a mosaic, a tapestry of verbatim Bible passages, perfectly suited not only for Epiphany, but for what else? For the end of the church year, for Advent, or even for the deathbed. Then Pastor Jonathan Fisk will join us as we continue our series on the book of Proverbs today, an introduction to Lady Wisdom in Proverbs chapter 3. Joining us to discuss President Trump's State of the Union address, Mark Hemingway. He's a regular guest and a Washington, D.C. journalist for 20 years. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
How would you describe the president's general message in the address last night?
Well, I think that's a tough question to answer, considering that the State of the Unions are always a grab bag of various ideas and sentiments. But I think that there was an overarching message of unity, which no one really kind of expected from Trump, but was a very smart political play in this moment. You know, we have a Democratic Congress that just took hold, so we have divided government for the first time in a while. And I think that there's space there for the president, who is not necessarily a traditional Republican and, you know, defies conservative orthodoxy in a lot of ways, or at least has historically, to step in and be, you know, a guy that's willing to cut deals. You know, whether or not conservatives, Republicans want that is another story. But as we saw, the snap polling in response to the State of the Union was pretty much off the charts, with, you know, 76% of people liking what they hear, precisely, I think, because it wasn't a bunch of, you know, partisan acrimony for once. It was, you know, a celebration of good things that Americans have done, you know, as exhibited by the visitors in the gallery, the World War II veterans and the Holocaust survivors and the hero cops and all of that. And, you know, and open appeals to Democrats to work with him. So I think it was a smart, you know, message.
President Trump explicitly mentioned abortion and late-term abortion. Why have presidents, even pro-life presidents, often been not silent, but a little mute on that in State of the Union addresses?
I think because abortion is viewed as a divisive issue, it's just, you know, one of these things where it's kind of a third rail that people don't want to touch because there is so much, you know, heat around the conversation whenever it comes up. However, I think Trump is cannier in some respects than a lot of politicians on this issue. For one thing, Trump, because he has to, you know, earn the respect and, you know, of social conservatives, considering his sort of, you know, crazy background as a wealthy philanderer, you know, has to sound credible on these issues, and I think that means going further than a lot of traditional Republican politicians to, you know, speak in support of these ideas. But also secondarily, the media, I think, is overwhelmingly pro-choice, and that, you know, very much shows up in their coverage. So they act like certain aspects of the abortion issue that cut against the pro-choice movement are much more controversial than they are. The subject that's been in the news, you know, recently has been late-term abortion and even infanticide, as we saw with Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's comments. And late-term abortions, even among people that call themselves pro-choice, are politically unpopular, have been overwhelmingly politically unpopular for a very long time, and I don't see that changing. So speaking out on that issue in particular was kind of a no-brainer politically, even though everything that goes on in the institutional media and institutional Washington tries very hard to keep people from saying things that might make, you know, the pro-abortion movement look bad.
Do you think that President Trump's speech last night was one of the most pro-life State of the Union addresses?
Well, I do think it was a very pro-life State of the Union address, but, you know, again, that's not clearing a high bar. Still, though, I mean, I really am, I think pro-life people have good reason to be happy with this administration. It's not just because of two Supreme Court justices, but it is actually, you know, backed up with, you know, real meaningful rhetoric in ways that other Republican politicians have been afraid to go near. You know, remember when Trump was running for president in that debate with Hillary Clinton where he challenged her on late-term abortion, I mean, that was just something that at the time it happened, I remember just being shocked because my entire adult life, I've been so used to Republicans who were so cowardly to address things like that, let alone to, like, point blank put it to this woman running for office that she was immoral for supporting this barbaric act, and Trump did it. And, you know, there's nothing about his term as president that has suggested to me that, you know, he's not acting as if this is a real conviction of his.
Hadley Arkus, author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and a guest on this program, has argued on the show for years that pro-life Republicans need to take the abortion issue to the Democrats and expose their extremism on abortion. Do you think that this is finally beginning to happen?
You know, it's hard to say. I don't have a lot of confidence the Republicans aren't going to get cold feet. But there has been more pressure on this issue than I have seen in a long time. And further, this is really good ground to fight on for once, because it really does expose the extremism of the pro-abortion movement, which is to say that, like, for instance, the Infants Born Alive Act, which I believe was put forth by Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, is not a bill in any way, shape, or form that restricts abortion access at all. I mean, it literally, you know, just protects infants who are born alive. And yet, you're still seeing lots of pro-choice activists and lots of journalists writing all of these, you know, sort of chin-stroking, you know, analyses showing that this is really some backdoor attempt to, you know, control women's bodies or, you know, some such nonsense. The reality is the bill, if you read it, does nothing of the sort. And I think that people really need to ask themselves, if the pro-choice movement isn't going to defend children that are that have already going to be born, then, you know, that should really tell you something about, you know, the moral compass of these people.
What message were the women dressed in white there in the gallery trying to send during last night's address?
Well, technically it was for, I think it had something to do with suffragettes. They were trying to, you know, celebrate their success because I believe there are more women in Congress than there ever have been. And they were trying to, you know, celebrate the crowning success of you know, women in politics since they were given the right to vote, you know, early in the 20th century. So that was the message. On the other hand, I don't know. I mean, there were times when there's a fine line between trying to celebrate women's success and when it looks like a bunch of, you know, successful politicians standing up and celebrating themselves. I don't know if it was always entirely flattering, even if I think the president was canny and right to celebrate the fact that women are, you know, able to, you know, succeed in politics.
President Trump promised last night, America will never be a socialist country. Why did he make this statement?
Well, obviously, you know, we've seen the rise of socialism in the Democratic Party. I mean, Bernie Sanders came, you know, reasonably close to capturing the party's presidential nomination, and he openly identifies himself as a socialist. The biggest rising star in the incoming Congress right now is arguably Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who openly identifies as socialist as well. And further, a lot of the ideas that the Democrats are running on right now, even among Democrats that don't consider themselves socialists, are themselves socialist ideas, such as Medicare for all, essentially socialized health care. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren has other crazy ideas about, you know, forcing companies to put, you know, a certain percentage of workers on their board, controlling boards and things like that. I mean, this is, you know, it's pretty much straight up socialism. So obviously, I think that's concerning. You know, part of me isn't surprised that this is where we're at, having watched the evolution of the Democratic Party in the past decade or so. But part of me also still is just kind of stunned that the President of the United States can say, you know, we must renew our resolve not to be a socialist country, and the Democratic Speaker of the House would sit behind him and deliberately refuse to clap. We continue to see the effects of socialism around the world. And just take one look at Venezuela right now, which was, you know, another thing that President Trump singled out in his speech. Socialism, by and large, does not work. And even the countries in Europe, like Sweden, that are known for being socialist, have been running the other way economically in recent decades and having some success getting away from sort of ossified command and control economies.
What was the president's message on immigration last night?
I think his message, you know, he said, you know, he wants a lot more legal immigration. I think he even ad-libbed that into the speech. You know, it originally said something like, you know, we need legal immigration, and he himself added he'd like to see a lot more legal immigration. But, you know, it was always understood for a long, long time that a precondition to getting anything done in terms of reforming immigration, in terms of legal immigration, in terms of, you know, providing amnesty for any people that are already here, was securing the border so that we don't have to deal with, you know, huge influxes of people in the future that keep causing these problems to arise. So, you know, hence Trump's Build a Wall speech, which, you know, is something that helped him get elected. And it's a weird situation we're in right now. I mean, Democrats can't afford to give Trump a political win on the wall issue because he's so heavily invested in it. But at the same time, you know, this is something that they've almost all who've been in Congress for any length of time have publicly supported in the past. I mean, everyone agrees we need more border security, and, you know, and even in the form of walls. Trump is, in his own weird way, you know, focused on the one issue that was supposed to be unifying, which was, you know, border security, which was a precondition for all the other haggling we do about amnesty and everything down the line. Partisanship is such that we can't much agree on that. So Trump is, you know, going back to the well, partly because Build a Wall works for him personally, politically, but also, you know, if you want to give him the benefit of the doubt, that is, again, I think the precondition for all future immigration discussions is border security.
One commentator observed that this was perhaps President Trump's least conservative speech, and he mentioned the absence of a small government message. Do you agree?
I think certainly that's not an inaccurate characterization in a lot of respects. There was not a dominant small government message, but also, because the issues weren't discussed doesn't necessarily mean that Trump isn't doing these things in other ways. You know, certainly if you look at his approach to the administrative state, you know, while it's not, you know, exactly a slash and burn as a lot of conservatives would like, I mean, he's certainly doing more than most recent presidents to, you know, reduce the power and influence of the federal government. So I don't know. The one thing I would say that wasn't mentioned there in the speech at all, again, was any sort of message about any sort of needed fiscal austerity. I mean, probably the biggest existential threat to the United States is the fact that we have all of these, you know, unfunded liabilities, you know, primarily in the form of entitlements. I mean, you know, dozens of trillions of dollars, and all it's going to take is one financial crisis where the interest on America's debt service, you know, doubles, and all of a sudden Congress no longer has any discretion. Income. Every penny we have is going out to pay people's Social Security and Medicare. And the fact that the Republicans as a whole, including the president, are unwilling to deal with this when this was like a major theme of the two Republicans that ran for president in 2012, I do think is a big step backwards, because one way or another, you know, the bill is coming due.
How do you evaluate the official Democratic response to the State of the Union last night?
Well, first of all, traditionally the Democratic response to the State of the Union or the Republican response, whoever's giving the response, is it's just a horrible gig. I mean, a lot of very talented and charismatic politicians have attempted to do it, and very few have had any success. There's just something about the awkwardness of it, the idea that it's supposed to be a response when both speeches are written well in advance. You know, it's on such a small stage compared to the big pomp and circumstance of the actual State of the Union. I mean, all these things conspire to just make it like a very difficult thing to do. Having said that, I thought that Stacey Abrams did a reasonably good job with it for no other reason than since she realized that giving the response was kind of a sucker's game, she didn't make it about responding to Donald Trump as much as it was a stump speech for whatever office Stacey Abrams is going to run for in the future. Clearly, it was a very biographical, very self-promotional speech. I thought it started out like really well. It ended on kind of a very sort of dark note because obviously it was written in advance and was saying all these things about Trump right after Trump had just given this sort of uplifting, unifying speech. So it didn't strike the right note in that regard. But as far as, you know, Democratic responses go, it was definitely one of the better ones I've ever seen.
Mark Hemingway is our guest. He's a Washington, D.C. journalist for 20 years. We're talking about President Trump's State of the Union address. When we come back, we'll discuss whether or not that message of unity, well, whether the president is the one who can deliver it. We'll be right back.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Concordia University Chicago's music programs will support your aspirations, whether you want to pursue a professional career in music or simply improve your skills. Experience a wide variety of musical learning and performance in a Christian environment. Auditions for music scholarships will be held February 9th, 16th, and 18th, open to both music majors and non-majors. Admitted students register today by logging into connect.cuchicago.edu.
Several Issues Etc. regular guests are candidates for leadership positions in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Every LCMS congregation has received nomination forms for the president and vice presidents of the synod. Please encourage your pastor and congregational leaders to fill out and return these nomination forms before February 20th of 2019. Learn more at issuesetc.org/nominations. issuesetc.org/nominations. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about President Trump's State of the Union address last night. Mark Hemingway is our guest. He's a Washington, D.C. journalist for 20 years. Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Peter Scare has been commenting on social media lately about his recent presentation to the LCMS West Coast Military Chaplain Training in California and praising the work of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Learn more about their work at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve, LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces. Mark, before the break, you were talking about the president's message of unity. Can President Trump, who many regard as a divisive presence in Washington, actually help unite the nation?
I have my doubts simply because of the rank partisanship, and some of that, or a lot of it, you know, was there long before Donald Trump ever officially ran for president. So, you know, can't always be laid at Trump's feet, even if Trump certainly doesn't help by going on, you know, Twitter and other things and saying a lot of the sharp things that he does. But more than that, though, you know, if Trump himself is divisive, it's not like Democrats haven't been embracing extreme rhetoric themselves. I mean, you know, there's a lot of sharp tongue rebukes coming out from Democrats these days. And, you know, you can't, you know, blame that on Trump. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around on both sides of the aisle. But at the same time, you know, Trump was not always a quote-unquote conservative Republican, you know, and he was, you know, a Democrat not that long ago, and has written a lot of checks to Democrats over the years, and I think, like a lot of businessmen, he has a very pragmatic view of a lot of problems. He doesn't necessarily see them through an ideological lens. So the potential for him to, like, actually work together with Democrats in the House of Representatives to get things done is there in ways that I think might surprise people, but at the same time, we just haven't seen anything to date that would suggest that that's going to happen.
This was a State of the Union that was on again, off again, literally. Can you explain the drama between the President and the Speaker of the House leading up to the State of the Union?
Right. Well, the Constitution mandates a State of the Union address. Traditionally, that has come in the form of the Speaker of the House inviting the President down to the Capitol to give that address. So when Pelosi formally declined to do anything about when to give the address until the shutdown was over, that was seen as sort of a big power move on her part and sort of a slap to the face of the President. So that didn't increase any love between the two figures there, I imagine. But at the same time, you know, Trump had done that stunt where Nancy Pelosi and some other Democratic congressional leaders were about to leave on a CODL to go visit a foreign country, and, you know, he pulled their plane at the last minute as well. So there was certainly no shortage of pettiness from both of them there.
In that vein, is this a State of the Union address that has been given between shutdowns, just this window between shutdowns? Are we going to see another one? Will it be over the same issues?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking there. Like,
is the government shutting down again on February 15th?
I have a feeling that Republicans are going to be loath to embrace another shutdown. Certainly, I think at this point in time, Democrats are in the driver's seat, and Republicans have already sort of, you know, ceded the ground once on this. And, you know, again, it's also hard to be sympathetic to Republicans on some level here, and Donald Trump in particular, simply because while they could have got their wall funding when not that long ago, Republicans had control of both chambers, but for whatever reason, it didn't get done. Part of the problem in Washington is that there are a lot of problems, and immigration is chief among them, where both parties have significant political incentives to allow the problems to persist rather than address them with, you know, basic solutions that people have been clamoring for a long time. You know, both parties have agreed on border security for a long time, but so long as Democrats have an incentive to agitate against any sort of, you know, immigration reform as being racist or, frankly, allowing people to come in to the country illegally that they anticipate will eventually become Democratic voters. And at the same time, you know, as long as Republicans can tell their base that, you know, you have to vote for us because, you know, we have to get border security, and then not do it so they can keep using that excuse in every election, I just don't see how it's going to get solved, because that's basically been the state of play for, you know, a couple of decades on it, immigration now.
Some observers were, even during the speech, calling this a pivot on the part of the president. What did they mean by that, and do you agree?
Well, I mean, obviously Trump has become a successful politician by embracing, you know, conflict somewhat explicitly. I mean, he was the one Republican willing to call out Hillary Clinton on her illegal behavior in ways that other people were afraid to. Americans on the right side of the spectrum very much felt that a lot of institutions like the media and other things were out to get them, and Trump was the first guy to sort of explicitly vocalize this without any threat of backlash, without feeling threatened by the coming media backlash. So certainly for Trump to get up there and give this sort of, you know, unifying speech wasn't what anyone expected. But, you know, you have to remember, though, that Trump doesn't have a long political career. I mean, you know, Trump really only started running at the end of the summer in 2015. I mean, it's hard to imagine that a guy who completely eclipses all aspects of our political life has been in politics for less than 4 years. So who knows? He may have a second act in him.
Do State of the Union addresses usually move the political needle?
I think they can, but they usually don't, simply because they have become seen as a PR opportunity. Typically, they include a laundry list of you know, sort of ideas that are designed to sort of intrigue the public, and, you know, float trial balloons and stuff like that. You know, I mean, was it George Bush, I think, that talked about, you know, going to Mars in the State of the Union? But, you know, obviously that was not something high on the Bush administration's policy list. So typically they do that kind of thing just to sort of get the public to feel good about them things. I mean, I think that the positive feelings in the State of the Union can linger long after people forget about the policy details that were or were not in the speech. But at the same time, I think that Americans are so inured to this sort of fuzzy, PR-focused State of the Union speech that I'm not sure that it's going to move the needle in the long run. If you had, you know, slightly better feelings about Trump after last night, I don't think it's going to take much for you to revert back to any, you know, negative feelings you might have had beforehand.
So, in the end, was this State of the Union different? He is known for doing things very differently than presidents before him. Was it different in any sense from what we have come to expect from this annual Washington on parade?
Well, I think it was a lot more focused on unity, a lot more focused on sort of positive messages about America as a whole. You know, he deliberately went out of his way to compliment the Democratic women in attendance and you know, all sorts of other nice gestures like that in ways that I don't think we've seen in, you know, the last couple of decades. Having said that, again, unless that sort of, you know, fuzzy sentiment is backed up by things that actually move the ball forward on policy and other sort of tangible things that we can all point to that actually lead to sort of a public thawing of animosities between, say, Democratic leadership and the president, I don't think many people are going to conclude that it was, you know, a smashing success.
So this is about follow through at this point, if the president is sincere about being a uniter.
I mean, you could say that about any political speech, but in this one, I do think that that observation is more relevant than most of the time.
Finally, how do you think this speech was received by the kind of the diehard Trump supporters? And there are many of them in the nation, the people who will vote for him again in 2020.
Well, there wasn't the combativeness that many of them like, but I think a lot of the people that are Trump, diehard Trump supporters, simply like Trump just because he's different. And they like the idea that Trump is willing to say things that other people won't say, as much as they like the idea that he's willing to challenge people. Oftentimes, those two things dovetail nicely. I think in this case, you know, Trump got up there and engaged in sort of like unifying nonpartisan rhetoric. And it's also true that a lot of Trump supporters aren't necessarily like hardcore conservative Republicans. You know, there's a lot of, you know, what we used to call Reagan Democrats out there in sort of the heartland that are not 100% on board with, you know, an ideologically conservative Republican fiscal agenda and other things that voted for Trump. So those people are probably also happy to see him sort of like breaking the mold in a way that redefines the Republican Party in a way that's sort of more amenable to sort of a union Democrat, you know, blue-collar, you know, Republican type a mold rather than, say, whatever the Republican establishment in Washington is. I think that they were definitely not off-put by the speech, even if it wasn't the pugilistic tone that they often like as well.
We often have these conversations, Mark, with your dear wife, Molly, in attendance. And I was curious, always am, when sitting there at home during the State of the Union, what it might look like in the Hemingway house, because you two often have slightly different reactions to big events like this. What was it like?
Well, I definitely did less yelling at the television than my wife. That was a joke. But we were just down here watching it with our children and commenting on what was going on. My office is in the basement where our television was, so I was sort of like half keeping an eye on Twitter while I was watching it. And, you know, we're just having sort of a friendly discussion about, you know, what was or was not insightful or, you know, good approaches to things like that. I mean, I don't recall anything sort of like jumping out, although I do remember that both of us were sort of astonished at the various times when Trump said things that were nice and unifying about, for instance, how we were at the lowest unemployment numbers ever for, you know, African Americans and people with disabilities and all these other things, when there were lots of prominent Democrats that refused to stand for those kinds of things. I remember us having a fairly strong reaction to that.
Mark Hemingway is a Washington, D.C. journalist for 20 years. Mark, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
When we come back, we are going to be studying the Epiphany hymn, I Want to Walk as a Child of the Light. Pastor Will Wheaton will be our guest. We'll start out talking about how this simple hymn, very simple in its language, is drawn almost entirely from Scripture, verbatim. We'll be right back. Are you looking for a new devotional resource in 2019? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
Faith Lutheran Church and School in Plano, Texas preaches Christ crucified. Join us each Lord's Day to hear law and gospel preaching and receive the Lord's Supper. Our classical preschool through grade 12 Lutheran school is second to none. The school serves home educators too with online classes in the high school. We are located at 1701 East Park Boulevard in Plano, Texas. Reach us by phone at 972-423-7448 or on the web at www.flsplano.org.
Did you make a New Year's resolution to get in shape this year? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness at Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness can help you keep your New Year's resolution. Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. Performancefitness618.com.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Peace Lutheran, Sussex, Wisconsin. Hope Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Grace Lutheran, Elgin, Texas. Bethany Lutheran, Naperville, Illinois. Emmanuel Lutheran, Alexandria, Virginia. St. John Lutheran, Mayville, Wisconsin. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Perrysburg, Ohio. Trinity Lutheran, Okmulgee, Oklahoma. Zion Lutheran, Gwinner, South Dakota. Trinity Lutheran, St. Charles, Missouri. And Christ Lutheran, Normal, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at the website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.